Good morning. My name is Mike Reck. I'm an attorney with Jeff Anderson and Associates. We are a law firm that represents survivors of childhood sexual abuse throughout the country and here in the Diocese of Buffalo. With me is Patrick Wall. Patrick is a former Catholic priest and expert in clerical sexual abuse. We're here today to discuss the recent developments here in the Diocese of Buffalo, primarily for three reasons. Number one, we are releasing a report that has been compiled regarding the clerics here in the Diocese of Buffalo who have been publicly accused of sexual misconduct. That report is available in hard copy, and if you want to go to the website of AndersonAdvocates.com, you can download a PDF of the report as well as photos and assignment histories for each of the alleged perpetrators. It's noteworthy that this report contains 13 names which have been compiled solely from publicly available information. Secondarily, we're here today to call on the Diocese of Buffalo to do the right thing and to release the names of other credibly accused clerics that it knows of, that it continues to hold in secret. Third, we're here to discuss the contemporaneous announcement last week by the Diocese of Buffalo of a compensation program that is available to some survivors of childhood sexual abuse here in the Diocese of Buffalo. First, with regard to the report, it's noteworthy that this report contains 13 names. Those names were compiled entirely from publicly available information. The assignment histories that have been created disclose where the alleged perpetrators were, when they were there, and their last known assignments for the church. This is only the publicly available information that we've been able to access. It obviously does not include the information available to the Diocese of Buffalo. Of those 13 priests who are displayed here, six of them are believed to be deceased, which then leaves seven alleged perpetrators whose current whereabouts and status is unknown to us. That in and of itself brings up an issue of vital public safety concern. Where are those seven individuals now? What safety protocols are in place on them? And what warnings have been made to the communities that they now inhabit? We have no indication that the diocese has been involved with criminal prosecution of these offenders, or whether any of them are currently under supervision or subject to reporting requirements like Megan's Law and things of that nature. The second reason we're here today is to go beyond this report that was compiled by survivors and survivors' advocates. There have been very public statements recently by the Bishop of the Diocese of Buffalo that the diocese is considering releasing the identities of the other known credibly accused clerics. Well, the simple reality is that the time for thinking about doing the right thing is done. It's now time to actually do the right thing. There are, by the diocese's own count, at least 53 clerics who've been accused of sexual abuse. That number of 53 stands in stark contrast to the 13 that we know of. That means there are, by basic math, at least 40 individuals who've been accused of sexual misconduct whose identities, whose histories, and whose whereabouts are unknown. The simple reality is that the church and the church alone holds this information. And up until today and through today, they have kept this information secret and kept it away from the survivors who vitally need the acknowledgement and the public who is entitled to the safety protocols that come along with the disclosure. We don't take the allegation that this is a public safety imperative lightly. The reality is that disclosure of these identities, regardless of when the abuse occurred, is important for two reasons. Number one, disclosure of the identities and when the church knew what they knew about them is necessary for the first step for survivors who are still suffering in silence. There are many, many individuals whose childhoods were affected by this trauma who to this day still think they are the only one. They've never seen their abuser's name in public. They've never seen the accountability, the acknowledgement that this happened, it was wrong, and it was not their fault. That acknowledgement is the first step toward their healing. Secondarily, the release of the identities and whereabouts of known offenders protects children today and children tomorrow, simply because the mistakes of yesterday by this diocese cannot be effectively changed and corrected without disclosure of what went wrong and how to fix it. The simple reality is the diocese has this knowledge. They could and should protect children now and in the future, and they should do so. Failing to do so is, quite frankly, unfathomable from our perspective. Various dioceses around the country have disclosed what they knew and when they knew it about their abusive priests years ago, decades ago. Some dioceses, even a diocese here in New York, has been sued under an allegation that by keeping the identity secret, they are actually constituting a public nuisance and creating a danger to the public at large. The Diocese of Buffalo is on the cusp of starting to do the right thing, and we urge them to do it without delay. The third topic that is very important for discussion today is the compensation plan that was contemporaneously announced by the Diocese of Buffalo. On one hand, the bishop has disclosed that the diocese is considering releasing these names. Contemporaneously last week, they also announced the institution of the IRCP. The IRCP stands for Independent Reconciliation and Compensation Plan. It is a third-party administered plan that will compensate some survivors of childhood sexual abuse. It is a confidential plan in that the survivors who qualify are protected. Their identities are confidential, and their information remains private. To the credit of the diocese, they have already stated that there will be no gag order imposed, and the survivors will be able to discuss their case and their settlements if they choose to, or keep that information private if they choose to. This program, while just announced last week, carries with it a deadline. That deadline comes up in June of this year, which is a few short months away for the survivors who are still struggling with this trauma and have difficulty discussing it. Unfortunately, those survivors are forced to comply with this deadline, and it's our belief that there is a support structure for those survivors, that if they come forward, they will be treated with respect, with dignity, and they will feel better having gone through that process. Now, this IRCP that the Diocese of Buffalo has created, while it does follow on the framework created downstate, originally by the Archdiocese of New York, and then followed by Brooklyn, Rockville Center, and now both Syracuse and Ogdensburg, in addition to Buffalo, have announced the plans. Buffalo's plan differs slightly in that it is only available to survivors who have already reported their abuse to the diocese. So that means while the bravest of the brave survivors who've already been able to talk about this can avail themselves to this plan and to the modicum of justice that can come with it. We wish to be clear that this plan falls short from the justice available in the court system. It is not full justice, but it is some measure of justice that does provide some acknowledgement for these survivors. One of the downfalls of this program, as it's currently instituted, is that it only applies to those brave survivors who've already been able to share their information. Those survivors who are still suffering in silence, wondering if they will be believed, are not eligible to this program. Obviously, the diocese should and could continue this program, as other dioceses in New York have, and reach out to those survivors who are in desperate need for that support and that accountability. Again, the deadline for those who are able to participate is June the 1st, 2018. Those survivors who qualify can avail themselves to advocates or can contact the diocese directly, but please know that we urge you to reach out to law enforcement and report these crimes. The district attorney has bravely called for survivors to do just that, and we also encourage them to reach out to law enforcement. Speak to the district attorney, let them know so that they can be sure this doesn't happen again to other children. To the survivors who are wondering about this, we say to you, you are not alone. This is not your fault. You did nothing wrong. Please come forward. Also with me is Patrick Wall. Patrick is a former Roman Catholic priest, essentially a whistleblower many years ago, and one of the most knowledgeable people on clerical sexual abuse here in the country. And he's here to discuss a few specific issues that are particular to the infrastructure and the hierarchy and their handling of child sexual abuse claims here in Buffalo.
Good morning. First thing I wanted to say, I think it's really, really important, is that survivors do not operate on a timeline like everyone else. It should be when the survivor is ready to come forward. That should be the timeline. Many survivors, it takes them decades to be able to deal with that incredible trauma that happened to them. Because we're not just talking about a small thing. We're talking about sexual assault, criminal sexual assault. We're talking about rape. We're talking about sodomy, forced oral copulation, all kinds of ugly things that, you know, those of us raised in the Catholic world don't want to talk about those crimes. But that's what our clerics were doing. That's what, you know, brother priests were doing. For a survivor to be forced into a timeline, it's ugly. It's really ugly. And most of them, honestly, will not respond in time. And we know that. And we know that based on past experience where, you know, we've worked on cases 20 years ago. And now they're still coming forward, 20 years later. That's going to be the reality. The other tough reality for some survivors is that they weren't sexually assaulted by a diocesan priest. If Buffalo is consistent like the other dioceses here in New York, they will only deal with a diocesan priest. So, for instance, none of the Vincentians at Niagara, none of the Franciscans at St. Bonnie, none of the nuns, none of the religious order brothers would be part of this program if Buffalo is consistent with the other dioceses. And that's the hard reality that faces us. So the timeline, I can't emphasize enough on how hard that is on survivors. It's really a torturous type of thing. And some family members may have to go to their brothers, go to their sisters, and say, you know, we've kind of thought this was going on. We always thought this was one of those lingering things they had, and they have to come forward. The other thing I wanted to point out to, I know it's obvious, but if you look at the data that we have put together, the distribution of the perpetrators, of only the 13 that we know about, and there are going to be more to come, that it's consistent throughout the diocese. Statistically, this is an impossibility, except for human administration, to be able to distribute the pain and distribute the criminals in order to get them what I call the geographic solution, in order to move those perpetrators across the diocese so that they will not be known. So as we're gonna go through a couple of these assignment histories that we've put together, and you're gonna wonder, well, where do these assignment histories come from? the documents that are sitting right there. The official Catholic directory, it's this really big, right? Big, ugly brown book. But the reason that's judicially noticeable and reliable is because since 1947, the Roman Catholic Church in the United States, in order to maintain its tax exempt status, has to submit that big book to the IRS in order to maintain that tax exempt status. And they tell the IRS exactly where every priest and where every parish is, so that that property and all of those operations maintain tax exempt. The second book that you're going to want to go and get is the Catholic directory published by the Diocese of Buffalo. The current one, of course, is online on the diocese website. You can download it, and you can see exactly, even to the specificity of nuns or brothers or whomever, exactly where people are from year to year. Now, these documents are not perfect because they are snapshots. So they're not going to give you a day-by-day breakdown about where the guys are, but they're going to give you year-by-year. Another set of documents that you're going to want to take a look at, they're going to be publicly available, are going to be at Niagara, at Catholic Universities in St. Bonnie. Right there on the shelf, you're going to see all kinds of things that are saved and maintained. And lastly, I wanted to point out the single best and most important resource on priests is going to be the Chancery Office. Not surprising there, eh? The Chancery Office maintains all these priest documents because it's part of what we would call Canon 489 files, the secret archive files. It's what Rome says to all dioceses across the world, not unique to Buffalo. They must maintain these files in perpetuity. So for instance, I want you to, if you could jump to the priest personnel area. A great example of that, if you want to see a Buffalo priest file, just go to Father James Cotter's file. And we got that not from Buffalo. It was publicly produced to us in California because after Father Cotter had problems here with children in Buffalo, they sent him to San Diego. And sharks do what sharks do. They eat. Father Cotter offended in San Diego, and he was part of the large settlement that we had and the bankruptcy that we had in San Diego. So if you want to see the actual contents of what a priest file looks like, it would be Father Cotter's file. Some other things that really jump out at you as you start to see the evolution of things. The first one, first top right, Father Relio. I hope I pronounced that correctly. All those assignments that he had, he's a gyrovague. He has no roots. He is moving from place to place. Also, you see all these unknowns. Well, you know, even with all, to be unknown is so strange in the Catholic world, because when the bishop assigns you to a place, they know every day where you're at. It's more like a military organization. This is not, well, he's kind of employed or he's not really employed. No. Every single day, there has to be a priest on duty at a parish. There's no such thing as unknown assignments. Those are things to look for and different red flags to take a look at. How about jumping to Father Engels in that second page? You see another category of thing that you see. One of the things I've really learned is that there is a one-to-one relationship between a priest and child pornography. A priest who acts out sexually with children, if you're able to do enough investigation, you generally find there's evidence of that. And here's a classic example. Also, when you see these guys that are sent off to various treatment programs, the Catholic Church operates its own in-house psychiatric facilities. One of the closest to y'all right here, of course, is the Southdown Institute outside of Toronto. Southdown is operated by the Canadian bishops, and it is a facility oftentimes headed by an American religious, believe it or not. And those priests, they go there for treatment. Usually it's a six-month in-house, mandatory, under obedience treatment program. And the reason it's so convenient to go there is therefore all the reports are coming in Canada. And I doubt that the Canadian Mounted Police are going to give the State Police of New York a call if any of that ever comes out. And it never leaves the facility. It's written down into a report. That report then is communicated back to the diocese. And where does it go? The secret archives. Those Canon 489 files. There's only two guys in the diocese that have access to that. The bishop and the vicar general. So it's kept very close to the vest. Now the chancellor, of course, is in charge of the entire archives, but only the vicar general and the bishop have access to these kinds of medical records, then they get placed in the priest's file. Another example for you, I think that's pretty powerful, is with Father Timothy Kelly. Which is obviously a very common name, so you gotta say Timothy J. Kelly. Absent on sick leave, or absent on leave a couple different times. There are certain key words that you see in the Catholic directories all the time. Absent on leave, absent on sick leave, without assignment, in residence in places, so just kind of hanging out at a place. These are all classic red flags that you're going to see. I think another one that really jumped out at me is Father Bernard. Father Bernard, from 1978 to 1991, he had 6 parish assignments in 13 years. They were churning him around. They were moving him around the diocese because these reports were coming in, and so they had to get him out of Dodge. Another classic example is Father Martlock. And the treatment facility that he's clearly sent to, as a church guy, you're gonna look at the assignment, 1999 to 2013. He's at P.O. Box 10 in Jemez Springs, New Mexico. Well, Jemez Springs, New Mexico is a rockin' place. It is a facility and a religious order that only treats fallen priests. And fallen priests, of course, is code for those who have offended and had all kinds of, quote, boundary violations, as we've seen in hundreds of files. So, servants of the Paraclete down in Jemez Springs, St. Luke Institute, in Maryland, which is owned and operated by the United States Catholic Bishops, the Seton Institute in Baltimore, the Southdown Institute in Canada. These are all very specific places, and all, which clearly by the assignment histories that we were able to put together, they all were used by the Diocese of Buffalo. So there has been a long, long tradition here of getting priests out of Dodge and getting them to treatment for the various afflictions of sexual assault and the crimes that they committed. You'll have other specific questions, I'm sure, as you take a look at these assignment histories. We fully expect more priest information will come out. We'll update our report and would be more than happy to answer any kind of questions.
Real quick, before we go to questions, I want to point out something that's been of great public interest lately. There's been a lot of discussion about Father Norbert Orselitz publicly. Yep. And when you look through the report, and I'm not going to talk you through it right now, but it's there, it's available on our website. His complete assignment history is available. That was compiled from the official Catholic directory, which is a year-by-year analysis for where he worked, where he was assigned by the bishop. This is available for all 13 priests that are in there. But when you look at Father Orselitz's history, you'll note that there are 2 gaps in the history where it is highly likely, from our perspective, that Father Orselitz was sent to one of these treatment facilities. Now, we can't confirm that because that information is contained in the secret files under control by the diocese. So that's something that, as we look at these reports, even the 13 that are publicly available, we don't know exactly when they knew what they knew. We just know that the diocese has this information and they can and should disclose it to the public. Thank you.
In addition to that, I think it's really important to say that, you know, a lot of times we get the argument all the time, well, you know, memories fade and people pass away and all kinds of things go away. But there is a long oral tradition and there are people still around that know what happened back into the 1970s. We have retired bishops. We have former vicar generals that are still bishops in the state. Cunningham, in fact, was Bishop Cunningham was Bishop Head's secretary, pre-secretary in the 1970s. So we've got, you know, on hand living memory, so that if the diocese wants to really compile this and put it together, the people are available. The memories are still alive. And that would be a great service to survivors, because that way, for at least the diocese to acknowledge that priest was an offender would be a tremendous help in their salvation and their own peace of mind.
Absolutely. Any questions?
Just for the record, if you could both say your first and last name so we know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Patrick Wall, W-A-L-L.
Hi, I'm Mike Reck, R-E-C-K, with the law firm of Jeff Anderson and Associates.
Talk a little bit, excuse me, about how you compiled this list, because I thought I heard you say earlier that it was basically public sources.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, these guys were already outed, as it were, as offenders. If their names were already known as offenders, what's the significance of the list? Why bother putting it together? Their names are already out there.
Sure, it's a good question. And that goes right to the point of why we're here today. The 13 names are already out there. What you have in your booklet now is a review of the official Catholic directory, which goes year by year through the assignments of each of these alleged offenders, so that those members of those parishes and those towns will know, in fact, this alleged offender was here. He was here during this time period. Perhaps someone in my family, perhaps someone that I know, is hurt and is suffering in silence. The other reason why it's very important that we acknowledge these 13 names, these are not new names. I'm not sure they've ever been put together in one location, but they're not new. But the 13 here differs dramatically from the 53 that the Diocese of Buffalo has publicly acknowledged. That means there are 40 alleged clerics from the Diocese of Buffalo whose identities and whereabouts are unknown to the public. So we view this report as a jumping off point. This is a stepping stone. This is what we can compile because it's the right thing. We ask the diocese to do the right thing and supplement it. Join us in acknowledging the identities and making sure that those survivors know they're not alone.
So you're calling out the Diocese of Buffalo, but have you reached out to them, and what have they said to you?
We've had no communication with the Diocese of Buffalo.
Were they aware that you were going to do this today?
You'd have to ask the diocese. I don't know what they're aware of, to be honest with you.
Yeah, the bishop, former Bishop Manzel, had said in 2003 that there was no shuffling. The priests weren't shunted around from one parish to the other. But if you look at these histories and that map,
Well, I don't want to mince words with the former bishop. What I do know is that map, which was compiled simply with the 13 names that we know of, speaks for itself. If they want to talk about it, as we think they should, then they should acknowledge. If they were utilizing the geographic solution by moving priests around, they should acknowledge that. They should fix that. If there's some other reason, then by all means, they should explain it to you all and to the public.
Mike, you said that you have no doubt there are others that have suffered in silence, that have not been previously identified, and the diocese has said there's at least 100 that they know of that have come forward. You're urging the diocese to include those people who have not come forward before to be included in the IRCP. What would you do if they say, because they've said they've already committed, we will counsel them, but they will not be included in the IRCP? What do you do then?
Well, at that point, we have survivors of childhood trauma who are not even eligible for the modicum of justice and the modicum of acknowledgement that the bravest of the brave are eligible for. The situation that you're envisioning would mean those who are still suffering in silence, who have not begun that healing journey, are not even eligible to the full acknowledgement. I would pose to you that that hurts survivors. It prevents them from saying, at the very least, me too, that's my offender. They could and should be able to do that for their own benefit.
Mike, does your law firm represent any survivors?
Yes, we represent thousands of survivors throughout the country and across the world, including several survivors here in the Diocese of Buffalo, some of whom qualify for the IRCP program, some of whom who do not.
Have they already reached out?
Some of them have, some of them have not. Some of them have received the paperwork from the diocese, and others are still waiting.
Do you plan on pursuing anything beyond the IRCP?
As I'm sure everyone is aware and has been publicly discussed, the statute of limitations in New York, which is in basic terms a time limit within which you can bring claims against abusers and those responsible for the abusers, is particularly strict. In general terms, if a survivor doesn't come forward and isn't able to go into a courtroom in their early 20s, the courtroom is barred to them. So aside from the IRCP, there are few options. Sometimes there are options that are available, and I know the governor has recently come out in favor of changing that statute of limitations, but as it stands today, we would encourage survivors who do qualify to at least consider the IRCP.
What about the public nuisance strategy that you've done in Rockville Center? If they don't release the names, would you consider that avenue here?
Sure. So what we've done in other dioceses around the country, first in New York, in Rockville Center, is we brought a lawsuit alleging that the Diocese of Rockville Center, by keeping the identities of its known offenders secret, created a dangerous condition, and that dangerous condition constitutes a public nuisance. That's a lawsuit that's been brought that's currently pending down in Rockville Center. It's been brought in other dioceses around the country and is something that, you know, we as a law firm consider for public good wherever we're able to work.
Patrick, just for our background, what do you do now that you're not a priest? Do you just work with law firms? Do you work with investigators?
Yep, I'm a member of Jeff Anderson Associates, and so my whole job is to help survivors. And obviously, when it comes to church documents, I'm the guy who reads it. You know, everyone, I don't expect anyone in the country to be able to look through an assignment history and to see a P.O. box in Hemet Springs and immediately key into Servants of the Paraclete. Or if you see the recon unit in St. Louis, if you see that address pop up, you're not going to know what that is unless you've lived in this space for several decades. And since I interviewed survivors for all these years, I'm fairly good at it, and it's a matter of comfort, because in a lot of ways, most of the time, we can't do anything legally. We're the statute of limitations stops us. So it's the only modicum of relief. It's almost like a downloading the confession in a way. And so that's what we do. And I continue to do the research, obviously, in pre-sex and secret codes a number of years ago published, taking knowledge, back through the ages, specifically, how the church has reacted in different ages and in different times. If a court orders, which is only happens once in a while, it's pretty cool. If a court will give us an order to allow us to go into an archive, obviously I'm the guy that goes in the archive. And so I've been in the Marinal archives, I've been in the Jesuit archives, I've been in the Irish Christian Brothers archives to be able to dig out that information, because I know it doesn't seem natural to you that an institution would maintain these kinds of documents, but they do in perpetuity. And it's just about, fettering and ferreting out that information. That's what I do.
Go ahead.
You mentioned a number of red flags that you specifically know to look for. Have mm-hmm. you looked at any of our local documents in that regard to connect the dots, so to speak?
We don't have them. The only thing we have is Cotter's file, which obviously we litigated in San Diego years ago. Yeah, that's all we have.
You spoke just now about the non-diocesan orders that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
And earlier you said that typically if the pattern is such in the diocese, the pattern is such in the orders. Comment a little bit more on that. Can we then assume about a number, or is there any way we can extrapolate and say that part of the problem is this large?
Yes, we can, because we have reports from Australia, we have reports from Ireland that have all been public. These are governmental inquiries about religious orders, and we have litigation across the country on other religious orders. So we can pull those numbers out. The classic number is 6% of clerics who will sexually assault a child in their lifetime. And this is over long periods of time. And that first number came out of Richard Sipes' study, an ethnographic study from 1960 to 1990 that he published. And then that consequently has, in certain places, that comes out too low because of the geographic solution. You're going to find certain spots where it's much higher. And the religious orders actually come out in a higher percentage. Mm-hmm. So the thing that's hard is that with religious orders, their geographic solution is not limited to the jurisdiction of Buffalo. Now, Buffalo did a good job as far as getting people off the grid, too. They sent people to San Diego. They sent people to Florida. They sent people, I think it's Brazil, isn't it, where y'all have a mission in Brazil? And so, I mean, they did it there. Both with religious orders, it's even greater because they cover tutto mundo.
You know,
so
what
the 6% number we can assume applies to the orders as well, at least.
Historically, that's what's held true.
You know, what your question really touched on is something that is a little bit outside the grasp sometimes on initial inquiry. The IRCP that's been created is available for, as we said, survivors of diocesan priests who already reported. That leaves out survivors of religious order clerics. Now, we would have to review the official Catholic directory to see exactly what the percentage is of religious order clerics and diocesan clerics. But in other dioceses, I know we've looked at this in the Archdiocese of New York, traditionally about 50% of the priests who work in that diocese were in fact religious order clerics. So a question here could be to the bishop of the diocese, if the Diocese of Buffalo is importing religious priests from whatever order, Jesuits, Benedictines, Franciscans, and allowing them under the bishop's direction to work here in the diocese, why are survivors of those priests not eligible for the IRCP?
Based on the 6%, including the religious orders, could, on average, what would you estimate the total number would be?
I don't think that we could make that estimate. I think the better question is, instead of estimating, instead of survivor advocates guessing, that information's available. The diocese has that information. They know exactly who has been alleged to have committed this act against a child. They simply have to make it known. The rest of us are, you know, kind of guessing and trying to push away the clouds.
Your question really brings up an interesting point, because I don't know if you remember, but back when Cardinal Law was removed and they had that big explosion, part of the result of that is the United States bishops hired the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and then the various dioceses, not everyone participated, but most of the dioceses then went through their secret archives, produced a confidential report, and sent that to John Jay. And so you see these letters from these various dioceses reporting just the diocesan clerics. They're not reporting religious, because the bishop doesn't consider himself the highest ordinary, the highest guy, CEO, in charge of that particular cleric. So if you're given a number, just make sure that you know that that is the diocesan number, for a John Jay report.
I think they reported like the 90 claims against the 53 priests back then. They said that was like 4 or 4.5% of the total in the diocese, even that the average is 6. Is it believable that it's...
Well, this is what I call the numerator-denominator shuffle, right? So when we need those religious order priests, we bring them in, and then therefore we can reduce the because that they're going to tell you the total number of priests that existed in the diocese. Well, then they take that against just the diocesan guys. But when they want to get rid of the religious order guys, then the shuffle, then they take them on out. And so that's why... obviously, you know, I'm a theologian, not an accountant or in numbers at all, but I do know I've seen this numerator-denominator shuffle so often that it's hard for me to take it real seriously when they start to put out numbers. Just be careful.
Is it assumed that the release of these names will bring forth more people who make more claims? And does that not make the problem worse in light of the deadlines, the fact that older claims have to be in the IRCP but not newer ones?
The problem exists. The problem is bad. Those individuals who suffered that trauma already suffered it. Them being empowered, those survivors being able to talk about it, to say this happened, me too, it was wrong, it helps them. Yes, it highlights one of the shortcomings of the IRCP in that they may not all be eligible for this self-created program by the diocese. That's true, it does point out that shortcoming. But anything that empowers the survivors to be able to acknowledge this, to heal and move beyond it, is a good first step.
Overall, how would you characterize how this has been dealt with in Buffalo over the years, over the last 4 or 5 bishops that have taken these priests and moved them around? How would you characterize that compared to what you've seen in other dioceses?
Well, I think that the Diocese of Buffalo has embraced secrecy, and that secrecy has bred shame and silence, and that has hurt individuals. And the diocese now is on the cusp of doing the right thing. And we would urge them to take that step, turn that corner, and do the right thing. Thank you.